1 hour and 15 minutes ago, and right now he should be passing in the vicinity of Canton Island in the Pacific. It's safe to say that the entire civilized world right now knows that John Glenn is making this country's first manned orbital flight. We're going to hear now about the reaction in our principal ally. So we'll switch to London, Alexander Kendrick reporting.
Well, just a few minutes ago, the United Kingdom's top rocket man said a fine piece of shooting. And the general British view, as expressed on the BBC by its air correspondent, was that the whole thing was made worthwhile by the announcement of orbit over Bermuda, especially since it was all done in public, unlike the Russians. However, I suppose the view of the British man in the street is typically one of understatement. They think that it's more exciting than a cricket match. The British national saying is, of course, third time lucky, but it's been modified by what happened at Cape Canaveral today. For today, Britain's national hope was that it would be 11th time lucky, as once again, after several weeks' suspense, practically the whole country listened to direct radio transmission of the much-postponed American space launch, and it was 11th time lucky. This morning again, the countdown at the Cape was a sort of spatial Big Ben in British homes. The BBC has been on the air continuously since 12:15, 7:15 a.m. Eastern Time, nearly 4 hours now. The latest agonizing delays were reported moment by moment, as heard exactly on American radio networks. It's regarded as striking here that today's delay should have duplicated to a large extent the first full effort back on January 27th. In fact, it seemed a repeat performance down to weather and mechanical defects, except, of course, for the final moment of the successful launching. The direct broadcasting will continue late into the evening if necessary, and all Britain, needless to say, is listening. And now back to Dallas Townsend at Cape Canaveral.
Alex.
Yes, Dallas.
As you said, the British have a tendency to understatement, and perhaps the fact that this is more exciting than a cricket match is just about the highest compliment they could pay. Would you say that's correct?
I think you're right, yes.
How widespread is the interest in this manned flight in Britain?
It's completely prevalent everywhere, Dallas. I think everybody in the country today has been listening to the BBC radio service. And, of course, the feeling here has, until now, when they are listening to the reports from Glenn himself as he goes around the world, most of the people here had a bit of exasperation over the nuts and bolts reasons for the delays this morning. And I would sum up the reaction, the national reaction to what happened today as being one of exhaustion, exasperation, relief, and then finally sheer happiness. And of course, this was added to by Glenn's own voice, calm and assuring and confident, and also a voice that seemed to express happiness after all these months of frustration.
Well, Alex, I can imagine that all of those emotions you mentioned have also been experienced right here at Cape Canaveral and around the United States. Tell me, Alex, has there been any official comment so far from the British government?
The government hasn't said anything, but here's about as high as you can get. Professor Sir Bernard Lovell, who is the director at the Jodrell Bank Radio Telescope, which is the largest telescope in the world, radio telescope, said, "I am delighted to hear of the successful launching of the American space capsule. I offer my congratulations to all concerned in this great enterprise." Now, of course, Jodrell Bank, which takes part in many of America's space events by tracking various space vehicles, was not participating in today's because the rocket was launched on an elliptical orbit and was not designed to come above the British horizon. If it had come over Britain, obviously it would have also gone over communist territory, and apparently that was one thing that they didn't want. But Jodrell Bank has been listening to the radio reports directly from America, and this was Professor Lovell's reaction.
You probably know, Alex, that Julian Emery, the British Secretary for Air, was here at Cape Canaveral a couple of weeks ago, and he offered Colonel Glenn the best wishes of the Royal Air Force.
Well, the Royal Air Force has taken part to some extent in this exercise. They've had some squadrons out in various isolated seas standing by just in case they were needed, and the British are thrilled in that they also have taken part in this effort, even though it was an American space launch and not a British one.
Is it safe to say, Alex, that the British feel that this is a triumph for the free world as well as for just the United States?
Well, they feel definitely that since the United States is carrying the burden of the free world.
Mr. has first to make direct personal contact with the astronaut, and if something appears to be wrong with him, then diver Dixon will fire a wrist smoke bomb, which will summon helicopter number 3, in which is riding Army Captain Jerry Strong, one of the 2 men Mercury medical team standing by here on the Randolph. We're waiting and ready to go, and Colonel Glenn is going to get a very big welcome from the crew of the Randolph indeed. This is Bill Downs aboard the Randolph, 1,000 miles southeast of Canaveral.
And it looks as if the crew of the Randolph will be able to make good on their slogan, which they coined in advance, Randu can do. And it looks as if Randu will do. Well, right now, Colonel Glenn ought to be in the jurisdiction of the control center at Kauai Island in the Hawaiian Island Group. And he's been on the way now for 4 hours and 25 minutes. We'll get the very latest as we switch once again to Mercury Control and Shorty Powers.
This is Mercury Control. The Mercury tracking station on Canton Island acquired the Friendship 7 spacecraft at 2:03 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The tracking station on Hawaii contacted the Friendship 7 spacecraft at 2:10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As we proceeded around from Australia toward Hawaii, we detected an indication of a problem with the heat shield deployment switch. A check was made over Hawaii, which confirmed that the system was operating properly and that the signal apparently was erroneous. He is also completing now his retrofiring checklist. And this is a process by which he makes sure that all of his onboard equipment is secured, that he has checked out his attitude control system, that he is in good condition and preparing to fire those retro rockets to begin that long landing flight toward the Atlantic. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that was Colonel Powers giving us the very latest good news on Colonel Glenn as Colonel Glenn travels eastward across the Pacific Ocean, heading for the west coast of North America and the moment when the retro rockets will be fired. We'll be talking more about those retro rockets in a moment. Right now, we're going to pause briefly for a word from Rambler and Ed Herlihy.
For Rambler, the success story continues. Rambler sales for January show another impressive gain over last January's figures. With record sales already established for October, November, and December, the 62 Rambler is the most successful new car in Rambler history. Early this month, the 2 millionth Rambler rolled off the line at Rambler's Kenosha, Wisconsin plant, putting Rambler ahead of all other compact car makes in total production. As a result of record-breaking sales, your Rambler dealer is prepared to offer substantial dollar savings on any new Rambler you buy. This coming weekend, your Rambler dealer will be featuring a weekend special deal on new Rambler sedans, wagons, convertibles, 6s, and V8s. Come see the successful new Rambler. 102 ways new and better for 1962. Take advantage of important savings made possible by Rambler's sales success. Ask your Rambler dealer about his weekend special deal.
Once again, here's Dallas Townsend at Cape Canaveral.
And here at Cape Canaveral, we're waiting for the moment that Colonel Glenn, aboard his spacecraft, will report that the retro rockets have fired. The retro rockets are estimated to be fired at 2:22.19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That is 19 seconds past 2:22 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, about 6 minutes from now. Well, we're talking now with CBS News correspondent Charles Von Fremd, who's covered more of these launchings from Cape Canaveral than most people. And Chuck, of course, right now the critical thing is the retro rocket firing. If everything goes normally, the cluster of the three retro rockets on the face of that heat shield will be fired as the spacecraft approaches the west coast of North America. Now, there is a prime method of firing, that is a timer on board, But it can also be fired, I believe, by command from the ground.
That's right. They can fire on command from Guaymas or Puerto Gro, and also the astronaut himself, John Glenn, can initiate the firing of the retro rocket. So we actually have three factors involved here, and I think this might be a good time to point out that one of the key words down here, we hear so much about A-OK and scrub and go and no-go and so forth, but another one of those words, I think, has to be redundancy.
Absolutely.
We have so many factors, built-in safety factors all the way through it, the entire flight, and this is just another example of it, that we have these three different devices by which the retros can be fired.
And so the chances are very slim that they won't fire by one way, one means or another.
That's right. And also, Pilot Glenn, of course, has shown during a greater part of this flight that he can handle the attitude problem himself, so it does look very good.
You know, Chuck, he said before he took off that he was hoping at some point or other to fly upside down. Have you heard any indication that he actually has done that?
No, and I'm sure that he'll certainly be asked that as soon as he is taken to the place where he'll rest up for a couple of days during the debriefing period.
Yes. Well, when the retros do fire, and we assume and certainly hope that they do, the craft won't be slowed down very much, actually only about 350 miles an hour, but that will be enough.
That's enough
to
kick it out of orbit, yeah.
To kick it out of orbit and allow gravity once again to take hold.
I still can't figure out how in the world these scientists can sit down with their slide rules and figure out the precise second to command the retros to be fired out over California, off the coast of California, and know with the precision they do just exactly where it's going to land in the Atlantic Ocean. It really is a fantastic thing.
It's fantastic, but it is necessary, as we've heard earlier, because it's because he's traveling at 5 miles a second, and every second's delay in firing the retro rockets means that some ship or other probably will have to travel another 5 miles to pick him up.
That's right. If he's off more than 15 seconds on either side, it means he's going to either undershoot or overshoot the recovery zone. And those ships out at sea don't travel with the speed of Glenn's capsule.
What about the heat temperatures building up on the spacecraft as it comes back into the Earth's atmosphere? They get pretty high, I believe, up to around 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, don't they?
That's right. I once had the opportunity to observe a Redstone rocket, the capsule itself, without a man in it. This was a very small payload, of course, coming back in downrange on one of the islands downrange, Grand Turk. And it was at night, and you could see this fiery trail coming down out of the sky down toward the water. And this was of course, produced by the tremendous heat that's built up as the object tumbles back into the heavier atmosphere.
Just a note here, the helicopters have been launched from the Randolph, Chuck, and they'll be heading probably for the area, the exact area, where they expect that the craft will return to Earth. Well, those heat temperatures are a serious problem, and it's a problem on which the scientists have had to work for a long time. The problem, of course, is to bring the craft back without allowing temperatures to build up inside the craft that will be intolerable for a human to stand.
That's right. That's going to be one of the real tests, too, of the McDonnell spacecraft on this shot. Although all the telemetry information that was received at Mercury Control on the MA-4, that was the empty capsule orbit, and the MA-5, the Unishot, all the telemetry data indicated that there was not an appreciable heat buildup.
Well, Chuck, we're going to interrupt ourselves for a moment here to get some further word from Shorty Powers, and we're going to switch now, hopefully, on our stopwatch to Shorty Powers at Mercury Control. Go ahead, Colonel Powers at Mercury Control.
This is Mercury Control. Our California station has made contact with the Friendship 7 spacecraft at 2:18 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. At 2:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the retro rocket firing sequence was initiated in the spacecraft. The retro firing attitude was assumed, and the three retro rockets have fired. They've been confirmed by the pilot and by our telemetry here in the Mercury Control Center. John Glenn's comment was it felt like he was going to send him clear back to Hawaii. The retro rockets have fired. The reentry process will be initiated shortly. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that's Colonel Powers giving us confirmation of what we'd hoped and expected momentarily. The retro rocket fire sequence has occurred successfully. It occurred at 2:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, about 2 minutes ago, so that our advance estimate of 2:22 p.m. was about 2 minutes off. It's a lucky thing that Colonel Glenn is not flying by our advance estimate. Well, now, when the time comes for the spacecraft to return to Earth, the first operation in that reentry sequence we're talking about involves the firing of the retro rockets on the blunt heat shield of the capsule. Now, what exactly does that accomplish? Well, we got this explanation a while ago from Colonel Powers.
In order to talk about retro rockets, you really have to begin at the beginning, and that is, what is an orbit? An Earth orbit is nothing more than achieving enough speed to overcome or at least balance the pull of the Earth's gravity. You can demonstrate this by putting a rock on the end of a string. You know that as long as you keep it swinging, the rock will stay out at the end. If you slow it down, the rock tends to fall toward your hand, or at least down. All we do with the retro rockets is reduce the speed by some 350 miles an hour. We have three retro rockets on the blunt face of the spacecraft, and they're fired primarily by the onboard timer. This is backed up with a radio command signal from the ground and backed up, of course, by the manual signal of the pilot. And all it really does is slow the spacecraft down by some 350 miles an hour. And when you do this, then you automatically let gravity come out and start pulling it down.
Well, that was Colonel Powers explaining about the importance of the retro rocket sequence. When the craft does begin to encounter denser atmosphere, that temperature we were talking about will mount up to about 3,000 degrees. That will occur at approximately 25 miles altitude. And at that point, the spacecraft will be moving at about 15,000 miles an hour. The craft will sustain temperature of that amount for about 2 minutes. And the problem will be to have it absorbed by the heat shield, which is made of a very special sort of plastic material and will burn off. Here again is Colonel Powers.
He's in voice communication, of course, with the recovery operation. As soon as the main parachute is out, we hear him.
Now, retro rocket firing. We have instructed John Glenn to retain his retro rocket packet at least until he gets over Texas. This is a precautionary measure to double-check on the seemingly erroneous switch location indication we had earlier. John feels he held his attitude properly during the retro rocket firing process and says that he can see the coast of California. He's now reporting cloud cover down toward Mexico. The spacecraft is now arcing down on its landing trajectory toward the Atlantic. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that was Colonel Powers reporting that the Mercury Friendship 7 spacecraft has fired the retro rockets and is now heading toward a splashdown in the Atlantic. Colonel Glenn has been underway now for 4 hours and 36 minutes. And as Colonel Powers told us, he's been in contact with the tracking station at Guaymas, Mexico. Within a minute, he ought to be in contact with the tracking station at White Sands, New Mexico, as he careens eastward across the United States. We'll be back with our coverage of America's first orbital flight from Cape Canaveral in just a minute.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is Dallas Townsend again reporting for CBS News at Cape Canaveral. And we're waiting now as the Mercury Friendship 7 spacecraft moves eastward across the United States, losing altitude now that the retro rockets have been successfully fired.
The next big thing now, it seems to me, Dallas, is the next exciting moment is going to be the opening of the Drogue chute from 21,000 feet, I believe it is, above the water. And then, of course, at 10,000 feet, the main chute. And these are the next two big hurdles that John Glenn must overcome before he's safely back to Earth.
Yes, Chuck, I think we ought to make clear that the opening of the Drogue chute doesn't mean that he's out of the woods yet. The Drogue chute is simply intended to put the spacecraft in the correct position when he is descending toward the ocean. And the main chute will do the job of slowing him down. Well, Colonel Glenn has certainly been a busy man during this flight, and he'll keep on being busy while the flight is ending, and it's now in its terminal stages, and even after the flight actually ends. Glenn has many things to occupy his attention, including that vital matter of assisting in his own recovery. Shorty Powers has summarized what the astronaut has to do at this point.
He's in voice communication, of course, with the recovery operation. As soon as the main parachute is out, we hear him, the recovery forces hear him. then he has a series of checks that he has to make in the cockpit so that if we either lose the spacecraft or people get to bumping around in it afterward, we will not gamble with the change in switch locations or control locations. So he notes all of these locations down on a prepared checklist. He also, of course, on the way down under the chute, removes his helmet so that if something occurs in the landing, he's prepared to get out the hatch just as Gus Grissom did when he landed. He's kind of a busy guy about that time. He's not resting on his laurels yet.
That was Colonel Powers, and we have just now received word that initial contact has been made with the spacecraft by Cape Canaveral, Florida. Colonel Powers reported just a second ago that contact had been made with the spacecraft by the tracking station at White Sands, New Mexico. It's now moving eastward, heading toward the northwest coast of Florida. And as Colonel Powers tells us, initial contact has been made with the spacecraft by the tracking station at Cape Canaveral. Well, Chuck, you and I were talking about those two parachutes that will deploy, the drogue chute at 21,000 feet and the main chute at 10,000 feet. There is another chute on board. There is an emergency
backup,
chute.
Backup chute, that's right. As a matter of fact, I think, well, we were talking about redundancy a few moments ago. You can point out again here that if either of the chutes does not deploy, Glenn can trigger them manually from the capsule himself.
Yes.
So the pilot has this much backup, too.
A question was raised the other day as to whether he himself was wearing a parachute, and we were informed that on this mission, the astronaut is wearing no parachute at all. It's simply a matter of depending on the main chute when it deploys at about 10,000 feet. And there will then come a sharp reduction in speed. Actually, the sharp reduction will have come before that. Between 55 miles altitude and 12 miles high, that's over a distance of about 760 miles, the velocity should go from 17,545 miles an hour to 270 miles an hour in a little over 5 minutes. And that's where Colonel Glenn will experience once again those 8 Gs. Now, here again is Colonel Powers.
Florida at this time, during his reentry process. We have advised him that the weather in his landing area involves 1/10 cloud cover and 10 miles visibility. This should not present any hazard at all during the landing operation. He is now maintaining control of the spacecraft using the fly-by-wire system and the manual system as a backup. This is Mercury Control.
At this particular point, those announcements from Colonel Powers and Mercury Control are going to pick up again in frequency, and so we may expect to be interrupted momentarily as Colonel Powers reports the return of John Glenn to Earth.
Dallas, that huge 65-foot radar and telemetry dish atop the Mercury Control building, which just a short distance from here, is now actually tracking Glenn as he goes out past the Cape toward his recovery area. It's very interesting to notice that huge dish swing very slowly.
Yes.
From west to east.
Yes, Chuck, moving slowly around to keep in maximum contact with the spacecraft. And if our advance estimate is correct, he should be splashing in the Atlantic in about 2 minutes from now. The advance estimate was 2:34 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's now 2:32 p.m. And we're waiting for the electric moment when we hear that the main chute has deployed and is bringing him safely back to Earth. Before that, here's a correction. The estimate is now 2:40. And once again, here's Colonel Powers.
Friendship 7 spacecraft is now encountering the atmosphere off the east coast of Florida. He is encountering the atmosphere. We estimate that an ionization layer involved in the reentry process is preventing us from having direct communication with him. This is Mercury Control.
That was a fast announcement from Colonel Powers. He's over the east coast of Florida, and at the moment there is no contact with John Glenn. Despite all the despite the presence of that main chute, the 63-foot main landing chute, the landing speed will be pretty fast, about 35 feet a second. And at that point, when it does land, the main chute will be jettisoned automatically. and the onboard electrical equipment will be shut down, and location aids will be activated. Now, Chuck, those location aids are another example of redundant systems. There are several means that are used to keep track of the capsule after it returns to the atmosphere and then splashes in the water. After all, while there are a lot of Navy ships out there, they can't cover every square mile of Atlantic, and there's a lot of it. Let's hear again from Colonel Powers.
The Mercury spacecraft is in its reentry process at this time. We have an indication that receiving equipment at Grand Bahama Island is receiving beacon transmissions from the spacecraft. We are not receiving any voice communication at this time. On the basis of his present flight trajectory, we estimate that he will land within about a mile of a destroyer associated with the USS Randolph at the end of the third orbit. This is Mercury
Control. Around the world astronaut.
And if you can hear that cheer that's broken out, well, we understand that we're getting a report now from the carrier Randolph, so we'll hear from Bill Downs.
Bill Downs.
The recovery area has been secured by the helicopters, following are three other helicopters, which carry NASA technicians and the official photographers. Piloting the recovery helicopter is Major Will Nelson of Wood River, Illinois, who has been a veteran and doing capsule recovery work since the NASA project started. His co-pilot is Lieutenant Frank Berta of Fox River Grove, Illinois. They are now heading around in a circle around the ship. We have not yet seen any sign of the drone parachute, a six-foot affair that opens up at about 40,000 feet to add stability to the flowing capsule. It is a perfect day here for this kind of an operation. The sky is unblemished. There is on the horizon just a few scattering of clouds. Otherwise, above us and in the recovery area, feeling unlimited. A wind of about 15 knots, about 16 to 18 miles an hour, is blowing. We are heading into that wind at about 15 or 20 knots and sailing eastward. On either side of us are the destroyers Nora and Stripling, about 40 miles away, in the event there is an under or overshoot. The basic plan calls for the destroyers to... The basic plan calls for the destroyers to pick up the capsule after the helicopters pick up the astronaut. We are now turning right. Captain Max Byrne has what the TV camera calls panned the carrier, are now panning the carrier slightly to the south and cruising in a more westerly direction. The three recovery helicopters are again circling the ship. All eyes are turning skyward. There has been no sign as yet of the Mercury space capsule. We understand that he should be re-entering the atmosphere. We should see the drone shoot very soon now. It's a perfect day, as I said, for this type of operation. The sea is only about 2 foot waves. It's a beautiful blue Caribbean yachty holiday weather, and highly recommended for vacations, they told me. We've been standing...